This week, we have Murdoch again because he never goes away. Mangione takes a plea deal that may change everything in his state case. The Tupac murder trial finally begins, and a convicted killer gets his trial judge removed. Let's get into it. This is the 13th Juror Podcast, where we explore the trials, investigations, and true crime stories that everyone is talking about. I'm your host, Brandi Churchwell, and this is Court Report, your weekly roundup of the biggest courtroom headlines, breaking stories, and the legal developments shaping the nation's most talked about cases. Last week, we talked about that unexpected emergency hearing in Luigi Mangione's federal case and reports that a guilty plea could be coming. Well, on Friday, August 14th, it happened. Mangione appeared before U.S. District Judge Margaret Garnett and pleaded guilty to the two remaining federal charges against him. One count of interstate stalking resulting in death, and one count of stalking through the use of interstate facilities resulting in death. And this wasn't an offered plea or some carefully worded admission where Mangione continued to maintain his innocence. For the first time, he admitted in open court that he planned and carried out the killing of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson. Judge Garnett asked Mangione to explain in his own words what he had done that made him guilty. Mangione talked about years of back pain and his frustrations navigating the health insurance system, as well as similar experiences that he said he had witnessed from other people. He said he learned that UnitedHealthcare would be holding its annual investor conference in New York City on December 4th of 2024, but that exact location had not been publicly disclosed. So, Mangione admitted that he posed as an investor associated with a firm managing more than $50 billion in assets and emailed UnitedHealthcare leadership looking for information about the conference. He said he received a response within an hour. He also admitted that before traveling to New York, he used a 3D printer to make part of a gun and equipped it with a silencer and magazine. And then he made his intent perfectly clear. Mangione told the judge, "My travel to New York and email to UnitedHealthcare was with the intent to shoot Brian Thompson." He continued that on the morning of December 4th, 2024, he shot Mr. Thompson in Manhattan and he died. And finally, he said, "I knew what I was doing was illegal." When Judge Garnett asked for his plea to both counts, Mangione answered guilty. And there was no plea agreement with federal prosecutors. The judge confirmed that no promises had been made to Mangione and that he had not been threatened or coerced into pleading guilty. He also wasn't pleading guilty in exchange for prosecutors to take off the death penalty because that possibility disappeared earlier this year when the judge dismissed the federal murder and firearm charges. So these two remaining stalking charges, they still carry a maximum possibility of life in prison, but federal prosecutors say that they do intend to ask for life, but the advisory sentencing guidelines could actually come out considerably lower, somewhere around 24 to 30 years. But the judge is not bound by those guidelines, and Mangione is scheduled to be sentenced on December 18th. Members of Brian Thompson's family were in the courtroom as Mangione admitted what he had done. Afterward, the family called the plea an important step toward justice, saying that while nothing could ease the pain of losing Brian, they were grateful that the person responsible had been held accountable. But this guilty plea may have accomplished something else, too, because Mangione is still facing a separate murder case in New York State Court. Immediately after pleading guilty federally, his attorneys asked the state judge to dismiss most of the remaining charges against him, including second-degree murder. So their argument is essentially this. Mangione has now been convicted federally for conduct arising from Brian Thompson's killing, and New York's double jeopardy protections prevent the state from prosecuting him again for that same conduct. Now, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office strongly disagrees and says that it remains committed to prosecuting the case. And then on Monday, that fight already changed the timeline because Mangione's state trial was supposed to begin September 8th. That trial has now been postponed while the judge considers the double jeopardy issue. Prosecutors have until October 9th to respond to the defense motion, and Mangione is due back in state court on December 10th. That's just 8 days before his federal sentencing. So at this point, the question of whether Luigi Mangione killed Brian Thompson really isn't in dispute anymore. Mangione himself has now admitted that he researched the conference, traveled to New York intending to shoot Thompson, and then ultimately killed him. But the question now is whether New York will ever get to put him on trial for murder, or whether this federal guilty plea could effectively bring that case to an end before it ever reaches a jury. We also have a pretty significant update in the Carmelo Anthony case. Remember, Anthony was convicted of murder in June for the fatal stabbing of 17-year-old Austin Metcalf during a high school track meet in Frisco, Texas. The jury rejected Anthony's claim of self-defense, and he was sentenced to 35 years in prison. If you want the full story in details, there is an episode on this in 13th Juror. But Anthony has a new legal team now, and they are asking for a new trial. And this week, they scored their first major victory. The defense asked to have trial judge John Roach Jr. removed from the case before he could rule on that motion. And a big part of their argument involved something that Judge Roach did after the verdict. Roach gave a TV interview where he was asked whether he thought the jury, quote unquote, got it right. And he said yes. The defense argued that that was a problem because Roach was still going to be responsible for deciding their motion for a new trial, a motion that would essentially require him to consider whether errors during the trial that he presided over were serious enough to warrant doing the whole thing again. Now, this is an important distinction. The judge who heard the recusal motion, Judge Sid Harl, did not find that Roach had actually violated judicial conduct rules. He said that he believed that Roach could personally be fair. But that's not the entire test. Harl said that looking at those public comments from the perspective of an outside observer, there was enough there to reasonably question Roach's impartiality. So he granted the defense motion, and Judge Roach is officially off the post-trial portion of this case. And that doesn't mean that Carmelo Anthony automatically gets a new trial. It just means that a new judge gets to decide whether he gets one. And retired Judge Michael Chitty was assigned to the case. And as of today, August 20th, he is hearing Anthony's motion for a new trial. And there are several arguments being raised there, including alleged problems with courtroom access, jury instructions, Anthony's decision not to testify, and kind of an unusual behind-the-scenes agreement between the original defense and prosecution about evidence that both sides agreed to keep away from the jury. So this is where the hearing got pretty interesting because we learned about evidence that the jury never heard. So the reason that they had originally reached this agreement, it was described in court as a gentleman's agreement to keep certain inflammatory evidence about both of the teenagers out of trial. The idea was basically to keep the case focused on what actually happened during that confrontation at the track meet and avoid pouring gasoline on a case that was already generating intense racial tension and threats. But now we're learning some of what that evidence actually was. Prosecutors revealed that investigators had recovered disturbing messages from Anthony's phone. According to the prosecution, one message involved Anthony fantasizing about stabbing someone and licking blood from the blade. Another allegedly included a picture of a knife along with a message indicating that he was close to doing something. Prosecutors also said that Anthony's former girlfriend had reported to a school administrator that morning that she was afraid of Anthony and accused him of stalking her. And remember, the jury that convicted Carmelo Anthony never heard any of that. There was also potentially damaging evidence on the other side that they didn't hear either. The defense said that they had evidence involving Austin Metcalf and his twin brother, including pictures that allegedly showed anti-Semitic graffiti attributed to the boys and another teenager. And that evidence was also kept away from the jury under the agreement. And I think that the context is important because you don't want to leave people with the impression that prosecutors secretly had all of this damaging evidence against Anthony and then simply forgot to use it. Both sides made a strategic decision to keep potentially inflammatory character evidence out of this trial. But Anthony has an entirely new defense team now, and they're essentially arguing that decisions made by his original attorneys, including how this agreement operated, are part of why his conviction should now be thrown out. So This motion for a new trial has now opened the door to evidence that the original jury was deliberately never allowed to see. And some of it paints a very different picture than the carefully limited version of this case that was presented at trial. Now, the question for Judge Chitty isn't simply whether that evidence is disturbing, because obviously it is, but it's whether Anthony's defense has established a legal basis for setting aside the conviction and granting him a new trial. As of right now, at the time of this recording, that decision has not yet been made. We'll be right back. And now to the never-ending Murdoch saga. Murdoch was back in court on Friday for a major pretrial hearing ahead of his April 2027 retrial for the murders of his wife, Maggie, and son, Paul. And this hearing gave us our clearest look yet at how different the second trial could be. Oh, and Alex showed up in his Sunday clothes this time, y'all. After appearing at the last hearing in an orange jumpsuit and shackles, Murdoch entered the court Friday wearing a suit. He was unshackled in the courtroom and took a seat at the defense table, looking like one of the lawyers, although he remains in prison serving sentences for his financial crimes. But the wardrobe change was definitely not the biggest development. First, the retrial is officially leaving Colleton County. Judge Deborah McCaslin agreed that the case should be moved outside of Colleton County and the 14th Judicial Circuit, citing the enormous amount of publicity, the Murdoch family's deep roots in the area, and, of course, everything that happened with former clerk of court Becky Hill and the jury during the first trial. The defense wants Charleston. Prosecutors don't, arguing that Charleston would be expensive and a logistical nightmare. The judge hasn't decided where they're going yet, but we know where they're not going, Colleton County. Jury selection will also look a little different this time. The judge plans to personally oversee the process, and when the defense raised concerns about how much control the clerk's office had during the first trial, the judge assured them this trial will be on the up and up. Another really important ruling involves Alex's own testimony from the first trial. Now remember, Alex took the stand and finally admitted that he had lied for almost 2 years about being at the kennels shortly before Maggie and Paul were killed. Well, prosecutors want to use that testimony again, even if Alex doesn't take the stand this time. The defense argued that Alex was essentially forced to testify the first time because prosecutors were allowed to introduce so much evidence about his financial crimes. But the judge ruled that his previous testimony can be used in the retrial, telling the attorneys, when you testify in a case, there are consequences. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that prosecutors get to just play his entire testimony, but exactly what comes in will depend on the other evidence that the judge allows in. But this is significant because Alex could never take the stand this time, and the jury could still hear his own admission that he lied about being at the kennels. And speaking of evidence the jury won't hear, polygraphs. So there have been claims about polygraph results involving both Alex and Cousin Eddie. During the investigation, Curtis Eddie Smith, Cousin Eddie, reportedly failed a polygraph when asked whether he killed Maggie and Paul, while Alex reportedly passed when asked similar questions. So polygraphs are generally inadmissible because they measure physical responses, not guilt or innocence, or even whether someone is actually lying. They're called lie detector tests quite often, but that's not actually what they're there for. They just measure the physical responses to questions. So the judge made it very clear that none of that is to be mentioned in front of the jury without her permission, and violating that order could actually result in contempt. So that's out. Now, the defense questioned whether Cousin Eddie had some kind of undisclosed cooperation agreement with prosecutors because several of his criminal cases have kind of been sitting around for years. Eddie was charged in connection with that bizarre September 2021 roadside shooting, and he was later indicted on separate allegations involving money laundering and drug trafficking. So years later, those cases still have not been resolved, and Creighton Waters told the judge, there is no deal. If there was, they would have told the defense already. The defense also wants personnel information involving two former SLED agents, David Owen, the lead investigator in the murder case, and Ryan Kelly, who worked on the financial crimes and roadside shooting investigations. Both have since been involved in separate controversies that the defense believes could potentially affect their credibility. So Owen was involved in another murder prosecution against Michael Colucci that was dismissed without prejudice, meaning it can go back to trial, after the defense accused the state of withholding potentially exculpatory evidence. Murdoch's attorneys want to know what happened internally after that case and whether Owen's personnel file contains anything that could be used to challenge his credibility. Creighton Water said that the Colucci judge allowed the state to return to the grand jury after evidence that Owen said he forgot was not originally presented. Waters also said that he was not aware of any kind of judicial finding that Owen had been dishonest, but he promised to verify what information exists. The second former agent, Ryan Kelly, actually later joined the Charleston County Sheriff's Office, but he was fired following allegations involving harassment and conduct unbecoming an officer. So Waters said that his understanding is that Kelly's termination did not involve dishonesty, but again, he agreed to investigate that as well. So the judge will review those records from both Owen and Kelly privately and then decide whether there's anything in there that the defense is legally entitled to receive. And then things got a little weird because the defense actually brought up a recent murder in Allendale County. And watching this moment in court, I was like, wait, what? And immediately started Googling because this is the first I had heard of it. Turns out it was the first that Creighton Waters had heard of it too. So the defense told the judge that it had learned through a podcast that they listened to from Fitz News that a 300 blackout used in a recent Allendale County murder might somehow be connected to the weapon used to kill Maggie. Now, if that were true, obviously, that would be huge. During the first trial, a SLED firearms examiner testified that the markings on the 300 blackout cartridge casings found near Maggie's body were consistent with casings previously fired like all around the Murdoch property. So the state's theory was that a family-owned rifle was used to kill Maggie, and that rifle has never been found. So if a weapon recovered in another murder actually matched those casings, that would be enormous. It could mean that either the missing murder weapon was still out there circulating after Maggie's death, or that the original ballistics conclusions were unreliable. So Creighton Waters was like, this is the first I've heard of any alleged connection. And he said he would be flabbergasted if SLED knew something like that and had not informed him. But during the hearing, SLED's general counsel was there and provided an update. Apparently, a 300 blackout was used in the Allendale murder, but when that weapon was entered into the National Ballistics Database, it did not return a match. So right now, there is no verified evidence that that gun was used to kill Maggie. We're talking about the same caliber, but not a confirmed match to the same weapon. The defense did get a limited victory involving unidentified male DNA found underneath Maggie's fingernails. So they want more advanced testing that could potentially identify whoever left that DNA. The problem is there's very little of the sample and additional testing could destroy it. So the judge authorized the first step, meaning determine exactly how much usable DNA remains. And then once they know that, they'll decide what additional testing can safely be done. And one of the biggest defense requests of all is still unresolved. Murdoch's attorneys want the murder and weapons indictments dismissed, arguing that investigators presented false or misleading information or evidence to the original grand jury, including the now discredited claim involving high-velocity blood spatter on Alex's white t-shirt. So the judge did not decide that on Friday. That fight has been pushed to the next major hearing, which is currently scheduled for November 13th. And finally, remember the egg juror, Myra Crosby? She was removed shortly before deliberations during the first trial and has long argued that she was unfairly targeted. Well, her attorney wants access to the SLED investigation into Becky Hill to see whether that information contains any kind of information relevant to why Crosby was removed. The judge said she intends to unseal that material with jurors identifying information redacted. So she said she wants everybody to know everything. Now, when you put all of this together, Murdoch's second trial is actually already shaping up to look pretty different from the first. We're getting a new venue. Alex's old testimony can potentially be used against him. There could be new DNA testing. The defense is digging into credibility issues involving investigators, and we're going to learn more about what happened behind the scenes with Becky Hill and that first jury. But some of the biggest questions are still unanswered. Will the murder indictment survive? How much of Alex's financial crimes will this jury be allowed to hear? And where exactly will this retrial actually happen? Those are the fights to watch as we get closer to April. We'll be right back. All right, let's take a look at some of the cases to watch. One trial that we need to check in on this week is the Mario Fernandez Saldana trial, because the first of three trials in the murder of Jared Breitigan is officially underway in Jacksonville, Florida. Now, if you remember this case, Jared was shot and killed in February of 2022 after encountering a tire deliberately placed in the road. He got out of his SUV to move it and was ambushed and shot while his two-year-old daughter was still strapped into her car seat. Prosecutors say that this was a murder-for-hire plot connected to the years-long custody battle between Jared and his ex-wife, Shanna Gardner. They accused Shanna and her then-husband, Mario Fernandez, of orchestrating the murder and hiring Fernandez's former tenant, Henry Tenen, to carry it out. Fernandez has pleaded not guilty and is currently on trial for first-degree murder and solicitation to commit a capital felony. And after 4 days of testimony, we're starting to see exactly where the battle lines are. The state has surveillance video tracing a blue two-tone Ford F-150 that they say was used in the murder. Tenen's DNA was found on the tire placed in the road, and investigators say that clothing and even his distinctive gait were consistent with the person seen leaving the scene. But connecting Tenen to this murder isn't necessarily the same thing as connecting Fernandez to it. And that's exactly where the defense is focusing. So Fernandez's DNA was not found on the physical evidence that was tested. Investigators can't identify who was driving that truck. And there is a 32-minute gap in the surveillance footage. And they acknowledge that there's no fingerprint, DNA, hair, surveillance video, or other physical evidence placing Fernandez inside Tenen's truck that night. So prosecutors are relying heavily on the connections between these men, and one of the biggest connections between them is money. So the jury has heard about three checks that Fernandez wrote to Tenen after the murder, totaling $10,000. Prosecutors say those payments were disguised compensation for killing Jared. And the defense says that there's a much less sinister explanation. They say that Tenen worked on Fernandez's properties, and he was just being paid for legitimate work. Now, right now, at the time of this recording, that may be one of the biggest questions in this trial that is not yet answered. Can prosecutors prove that Mario Fernandez didn't just know the man that they say killed Jared, but actually hired him to do it? Because Tenen himself is no longer cooperating with prosecutors. He withdrew his previous guilty plea earlier this year and is now scheduled to stand trial separately in 2027. And Shanna Gardner's trial is scheduled to begin next month. So Mario Fernandez's trial is expected to continue through next week, and we will definitely keep an eye on this one. All right, y'all, another huge case, huge case that we're watching right now is, of course, Keefe D. Nearly 30 years after Tupac was murdered, Dwayne Keefe D. Davis is finally on trial. And the story of how prosecutors eventually got here is kind of unbelievable, because for years, Keefe D. apparently thought that he could talk about what happened that night without those statements coming back to haunt him. Back in 2008 and 2009, Keefe D. spoke to investigators working on a joint federal and LAPD task force under what's known as a proffer agreement. Basically, he agreed to give investigators information, and in exchange, the statements that he made during that protected interview could not simply be turned around and used to prosecute him, subject to the terms of that agreement. But, and this is the important part, a proffer agreement is not blanket immunity for everything you say for the rest of your life. And Keefe D. just kept on yapping. He gave interviews, he appeared in documentaries, and then in 2019, he co-wrote an entire memoir called Compton Street Legend, where he publicly described his version of what happened the night that Tupac was shot. In the book, KVD placed himself inside the Cadillac from where the shots were fired and described providing the gun that was used in the attack. Those public statements helped revive the investigation that eventually led to his 2023 arrest. And here's the part that is almost tailor-made for a prosecutor. KVD wrote that of all the people who were there that night, only he and Suge Knight are still alive. The other three men that prosecutors say were inside the Cadillac with KVD have all since died. So years after receiving protection for what he told investigators, KVD essentially went public with the story himself. And now prosecutors are using his own words against him. So his attorneys tried to keep the memoir out of this trial, arguing in part that his earlier proffer agreement protected him and that portions of the book were fictionalized or embellished. But the judge rejected that argument and ruled that Compton Street legend can be used as evidence, which has created one of the strangest defense strategies I think I've seen in a while, because prosecutors are basically saying, believe KVD. He told you what happened. It's right there in his memoir. And his own attorneys are essentially saying, don't believe our client. They argue that KVD just exaggerated and embellished these stories for attention and money and notoriety, and that his public statements should not be treated as a reliable confession to murder. And that's kind of the backdrop for what's happening in the trial right now. Prosecutors say that KVD was not the person who actually fired the shots. Instead, they say that he was the shot caller who orchestrated the retaliation after Tupac and members of his entourage attacked KVD's nephew, Orlando, aka Baby Lane Anderson, inside the MGM Grand earlier that night. They say that KVD obtained the gun and was inside the white Cadillac when someone in that car opened fire on Tupac and Suge Knight. So after almost 30 years, the question for this jury may ultimately come down to something kind of crazy. Was KVD telling the truth all those years when he publicly described his role in Tupac's murder? Or was he, as his lawyers now argue, he's just bragging about a crime he didn't commit, no biggie. And prosecutors are now trying to use the rest of the evidence to prove that the story that KVD spent years telling was actually true. So we have to talk about one of the more entertaining witnesses of the week. That is James Mob James McDonald. This is a former gang member who also worked as the head of security for Suge Knight. So McDonald was there under subpoena, and he made it very clear almost immediately that he did not want to be there. He talked about the gang rivalry surrounding Death Row Records and Bad Boy Records in the 90s and how those relationships basically intensified tensions between the Mob Piru Bloods and Southside Compton Crips. But once the questions started getting closer to what happened around the time Tupac was killed, McDonald basically said, we ain't doing this. He told the attorneys that there were things that happened that night and in the weeks afterward that people haven't talked about for 30 years, and he wasn't going to be the one to start now. In fact, McDonald essentially declared himself a hostile witness, telling the attorneys that he had warned them beforehand that if they made him come to court, they better be prepared to treat him like one. But my favorite moment actually came when KVD's own attorney started questioning him. Michael Snaft asked McDonald about the tension in Compton after Tupac's murder, and McDonald immediately realized that answering the question could potentially hurt KVD. So he looks at KVD and basically says, look, we might not like each other, but I'm not trying to send you to prison.
At the time you live in Compton, you go back to Compton and you tell us that there was a lot of tension. Can you describe that for us when you went back in terms of what kind of tension we're talking about?
Are you sure you want me to answer that?
Is it going to be graphic?
No, I ain't going to. I got ways to word it, but you asking me a question, I don't. And what I explained to them, I don't want to send him to prison.
Sure.
Even though we don't like each other.
Sure.
I don't want to send you to prison. So that's why I'm here where I'm at and the way I am, because I've changed my life.
So the attorney keeps pushing and McDonald keeps refusing. And eventually, McDonald looks directly at KVD and basically tells him, Talk to your lawyer, man. This dude is tripping.
Right. Do you know who was that was there?
I know everybody that was there.
Okay. Like who?
Talk to your lawyer, man. This dude is tripping. I'm not going to explain that. I can't answer that.
Y'all, when the prosecution's witness starts giving the defendant legal advice about his own attorney, we have officially entered a different kind of trial. But underneath how funny that exchange was, it actually demonstrates one of the biggest problems with prosecuting a murder 30 years later. There are witnesses who know things, but don't want to talk. And there are people who have died, memories that have faded, and some of the people who were part of this world in 1996 have apparently spent three decades operating under the understanding that what happened there stays there. And prosecutors now have to convince those people to talk about it in front of a jury. Not an easy feat. But we'll continue following along with this trial. And once this trial wraps up, I will probably end up doing a full 13th juror episode on it because there is a lot to this story. We'll be right back. Moving into cases making headlines, we have an update in a case that is close to home for me, one that I have been following for several weeks now. Isabel Johnson has finally been captured. Now, if you remember, Isabel was wanted in connection with the murder of 43-year-old Jason Coulthard, who disappeared from Niceville back in May. His remains were eventually found on June 25th, buried in a shallow grave on a property in Freeport. So investigators later identified Isabel as their suspect and charged her with murder. But by then, Isabel was gone. And what followed was a 45-day, three-state manhunt through Florida, Georgia, and Alabama. Investigators described Isabel as a master manipulator who used multiple aliases and allegedly convinced people to help her by telling stories about domestic violence and other hardships. And apparently, she had quite a bit of help. Five people have now been arrested and accused of helping Johnson after the murder. There's Bobby Wagstaff, Martin and Sandra Leverton, Michael Ray White, and Kathleen Morris, and all five are facing accessory after-the-fact charges. Authorities allege that they helped Isabel in different ways, from providing transportation and places to stay to helping her move around while law enforcement was searching for her. But after 45 days, investigators finally got the break they needed. And interestingly enough, it came from Isabel's own communications. Authorities say that they received information that Isabel had been communicating with someone. So Walton County Sheriff's Office Cybercrime Unit obtained a digital search warrant, traced an IP address connected to those communications, and pinpointed her location at a home near Cottondale in Jackson County, Florida. So on Thursday afternoon, members of a U.S. Marshals task force surrounded the home and arrested Isabel without incident. And because sometimes you really can't write this stuff, after spending a month and a half hiding from police, Isabel Johnson was arrested wearing a t-shirt that said, "Force to be reckoned with." Isabel has now been returned to Walton County, where she's being held without bond on a first-degree premeditated murder charge. And investigators say that they're still working to determine who else may have helped her while she was on the run. So those five accessory arrests may not be the last. All right, before we go, let's close out with a few juror notes. Just some quick updates on cases that we've either been following or cases that have some updates. First, Nick Reiner has now been indicted by a Los Angeles County grand jury in the murders of his parents, Rob and Michelle Reiner. And the indictment adds a significant new allegation. Prosecutors say that Nick was lying in wait before the attack. He has pleaded not guilty. The indictment also means that prosecutors can bypass a public preliminary hearing and move the case toward trial. The special circumstances alleged make Reiner eligible for the death penalty, although prosecutors have not yet decided whether they will seek it. His next criminal court hearing is scheduled for September 15th. All right, next up, remember Kamal Pedlowski, the Florida man that said that it was his best friend that he killed? There was that brutal surveillance video from the Ruskin Marina, and Pedlowski had punched his best friend and then pushed him off of the dock into the water and he died. Well, a jury convicted him of first-degree murder last month for killing his quote-unquote best friend, Melvin Jimenez, after the two men met while drinking over Memorial Weekend in 2024. Well, Podlowski was sentenced this week to life in prison. Judge Michelle Sisko called it one of the most senseless murders she had ever seen captured on video. We also have an update on Donna Adelson's appeal in the Dan Markell murder-for-hire case. Oh, Donna. Donna filed her notice of appeal after her conviction last year, but her attorneys have now asked for additional time to file the actual appellate brief because Donna suffered what they described as a medical emergency in prison. According to the sealed motion obtained by Court TV, Donna reported an abscess on her arm about the size of a tennis ball and was told that medical staff suspected MRSA and was later admitted for treatment. Now, her attorney said that they had been unable to speak with her to finish reviewing the appeal brief, and Donna remains at Homestead Correctional Institution serving a life sentence. So, poor Donna. And finally, Billy Wagner, the last member of the Wagner family still awaiting trial in the 2016 Pike County massacre, has apparently had enough of waiting. Wagner sent Judge Jonathan Hine a handwritten letter, Sarah Boone style, asking for a hearing and complaining that no one explains anything to him. He said he has difficulty reading and writing and is legally deaf in one ear, and he believes that he's being kept in the dark about this case. A fellow inmate apparently helped him write the letter. And interestingly, Wagner isn't the only one frustrated. Families of the eight victims are asking the judge for answers too, specifically where this trial is actually going to happen. Wagner's trial is now scheduled for January 11th of 2027, and while the judge previously ordered it moved out of Pike County, he still hasn't publicly identified the new venue. So prosecutors are now asking him to reconsider the change of venue altogether. So, yes, apparently after 10 years, both the defendant and the victim's families would just like someone to tell them where they're going to be at court. And finally, remember Dr. Gerhard Koenig, the anesthesiologist accused of attacking his wife during a hike in Hawaii and then trying to push her off a cliff? Well, the jury acquitted him of attempted murder but convicted him of the lesser offense of attempted manslaughter based on extreme mental or emotional disturbance. But afterward, jurors spoke publicly and said that they didn't believe that Koenig actually intended to kill his wife. And that's potentially a big problem because of the way that they were instructed to reach that lesser verdict. So Koenig's attorneys are now asking for the conviction to be thrown out, arguing that the jury may have misunderstood the instructions. And in an unusual development, the judge says that he believes the law requires him to bring the jurors back and question them about what happened before he can actually decide the issue. So that hearing is now scheduled for September 11th. So that's definitely something to watch. So that's your court report for this week. I'll be back next week with the latest developments. Until then, keep asking questions, keep looking at the evidence, and decide for yourself what you believe. My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator and host of the 13th Juror podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to follow the show on your favorite podcast platform and leave a rating or review. For additional episodes, case updates, and more information about the podcast, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com. The evidence has been presented, the arguments have been made, and now comes the same question faced by every juror. What do you believe? Thank you for listening.